Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear the conclusion of a lecture by John F. Haught, Senior Fellow in Science and Religion at the Woodstock Theological Center at Georgetown University, and author of several books, including the upcoming Making Sense of Evolution, Darwin, God, and the Drama of Life, to be published by Westminster John Knox Press. Dr. Haught's topic is Science, Faith, and the New Atheism, of which we heard the beginning last week. In the first part of his lecture, Dr. Haught identified the predominant advocates of the new atheism, Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, and Daniel Dennett. He talked about the four obvious truths of the new atheism, those being 1, that there is too much unnecessary misery in the world, 2, the underlying cause of this misery is faith, or as they put it, belief without evidence, 3, the solution to unnecessary misery is to get rid of every kind of faith, and 4, the way to rid the world of faith is to fill everyone's minds with science and reason. According to Dr. Haught, the intellectual beliefs or assumptions of the new atheists are what he calls scientism, that science and the scientific method are the only trustworthy way to the truth. Dr. Haught says that this leads him to 3 basic questions, the first 2 of which he outlined last week. 1, is scientism a reasonable belief? And 2, what is the actual meaning of evidence? This event was sponsored by Creighton's Graff Chair in Catholic Theology and Creighton Science and Religion Dialogue Project, funded by a Templeton grant. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, September 24, 2009, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to continue his lecture, Science, Faith, and the New Atheism, is John F. Haught.
Now let me move on to the third and, to me, the most interesting new feature of the new atheism, and especially in Dawkins and Dennett. And that's their contention that if you want to really understand what religion is about, indeed, if you want to understand what anything in life is about, you have to go back to Darwin. And hasn't Darwin explained religion away by explaining it as an adaptation that allows our genes to get into the next generation? And so now that we've understood the biological reason why we're religious, we don't need to take religious ideas seriously anymore. And therefore, there's no more room for theology in the age of science. So the question I've been working on most of my professional life is this question: is there room for both science and theology? And I want to preface this discussion by emphasizing that I fully accept evolutionary biology. Not only do I accept it, I'm enthused by it, I'm excited by it. I think it's a great gift in the end to theology. But the new atheists see evolution as incompatible with theology. And on this point, again, they agree with the creationists and the intelligent design people. They picked up their theology from visiting the websites and the campsites of creationists. They very seldom read mainline theologians. And if you read their books, you see more and more as you go through them that what they're really against is the kind of religiosity that is based upon biblical literalism. But yet they end up privileging the same kind of literalism in their debate with the biblical literalists. It's just the difference is that they don't accept the Bible as scientifically true, whereas the creationists do. So if there's going to be room for both evolutionary explanations and theological explanations, it seems to me we would have to make, first of all, an in-principle argument for the possibility of what I'm going to call layered explanation. And by layered explanation, I mean to point to the fact that almost everything in our experience admits of a plurality of distinct and non-competing levels of understanding or explanation. The simplest example I've been able to come up with is one that was suggested to me some time ago in a work by John Polkinghorne, an Anglican priest and also a world-famous physicist. Suppose there's a pot of water boiling on your stove, and someone comes into your kitchen and asks, "Why is that pot of water, why is that kettle boiling? Explain it to me." Well, at one level, you could say, well, the pot is boiling because the molecules of H2O are making a transition from the liquid state to the gaseous state. And that's why the water is boiling. And you could spend a whole career, some physicists do, on the phenomenon of phase transitions, which the closer you look at them, the more interesting they become. So you could stay on that plane of explanation for forever if you wanted. But you could also have answered just as easily, why is the kettle boiling? Because I turned the gas on. Or you could also have answered, and this is probably what you would have said, it's boiling because I want tea. Now you notice these are all legitimate answers to the question, why is the kettle boiling? But there's no competition whatsoever among these levels, no conflict. In other words, you don't say the water's boiling because of molecular motion rather than because I want tea. And you don't say it's boiling because I want tea rather than because of molecular movement. But in the debate over Darwin and theology, that rather than is the kind of terminology that appears time and time again. I was a witness to the plaintiffs in the trial regarding intelligent design that took place in Pennsylvania several years ago. And the argument there was, as the media presented it, as they formalized it, does diversity come about by way of natural selection, Darwinian selection, or instead, or rather, by divine creativity? As though the two were incommensurate and competitive and conflicting ways of approaching things. And what I suggested, and my lawyers who quizzed me in the trial had me suggested, that the theological kind of explanation falls more analogously along the lines of an I want tea type of explanation. And you don't want to put theological explanation at the same level as molecular movement. But the advocates of intelligent design were trying to squeeze the category of a theological category of intelligent design at the same plane as the molecular movement of the water, as it were. So the only way out of the situation, the conflict, it seems to me, that's going on in our culture today, the only way out of the Darwin Wars is to make allowance in your mind to tolerate a plurality of levels of understanding. But neither the creationists or intelligent design people on the one hand, nor the new atheists on the other, are willing to do this. For Richard Dawkins, for example, there's only one explanatory slot available to all. And if science occupies that slot, there's no room for theology. For the creationists, the theology of Genesis, as it's literally interpreted, should occupy that slot, and Darwinian science should be muscled out. And that's how the discussion goes on and on. So it seems to me the only way to resolve this is to move from an explanatory monism, a kind of reductionism that makes only one level of explanation valid, to an explanatory pluralism. So the essence of scientism, to come back to my main point, is that there is only one explanatory slot available. Well, is that necessarily the case? The ancient philosophers were very comfortable with layered explanation. For example, Plato, in his dialogue Phaedo, has Socrates and his friends sitting around in prison, and the friends ask Socrates, why are you sitting here in prison? And he teases them, and he says, I'm sitting here because my body is composed of bones and sinews, and the bones are rigid and separated at the joints, but the sinews are capable of contraction and relaxation and so forth, and that's why I'm sitting here. But he's teasing. A deeper explanation, he's sitting there because the Athenians had condemned him, and he thought it right and honorable to accept their penalty. And Plato, in his philosophy and his reflections on this event in the life of Socrates, goes one step further. The ultimate explanation for why Socrates is sitting there is that the attractive power of the good, of the divine, had grasped hold of Socrates. Socrates had allowed himself in faith, as it were, to be grasped by the good. And the good would not let go of him. And that's the ultimate reason why he's sitting there in prison. So layered explanation, you find it in Aristotle, Augustine, Aquinas, and you find it everywhere until modern times. Scientism, the essence of scientism, in a way, is to deny the value of layered explanation. So when we come to the question of evolution, why are there so many species of life, seems to me there's no reason why we can't adopt a layered approach toward that either. At one level, yes, there's diversity of life because genes can undergo mutations. Some of these genetic changes can be selected and are more adaptive reproductively than others and so forth. Because of natural selection, genetic drift, and a lot of other things that evolutionary biologists and other scientists are coming up with as they try to explain in depth why there's such incredibly beautiful diversity of life on our planet, would it necessarily be a contradiction to those explanations if we also add another layer, sort of the I want tea layer, that there's so much diversity of life because of a divine concern at the bottom of all things and delight in, on the part of God, of spontaneity and diversity in life? Why can't those different explanations just get along somehow? Charles Kingsley wrote to Charles Darwin right after Darwin produced The Origin of Species. Kingsley was an Anglican theologian, deeply religious man. He says, it's not so much that God makes things as that God makes things make themselves. So Darwin has given us an understanding of God where God is much more impressive. A God who can make things that can make themselves is much more impressive than a God who has to constantly be tinkering in the manner of intelligent design to correct the creation. So theological explanation, if you can accept layered explanation, doesn't necessarily contradict scientific explanations of life. Well, to come to the really interesting question that the new atheists are interested in, and that's the question, why have we humans been so persistently and annoyingly and stubbornly, and obstinately religious for so many generations? And why are people still today inclined to be so religious? Why have most people believed in gods or God? Well, the new atheists who are impressed by Darwinian explanations think the answer lies in this. We are religious because it has been reproductively advantageous for us to be religious. Religion helped our ancestors reconcile themselves to what is really an impersonal and indifferent universe. It gave them the illusion that life is worth living. It made them, therefore, aspire to live good and upright lives, to have children, to pass their genes on from one generation to the next. And it's because our ancestors were fooled into the belief that life is worth living that we are here today. So we owe our existence, in a way, to a lie, to a noble lie that our ancestors followed because they did not have the Darwinian truth that we have today. That's the explanation in a nutshell. It's more complicated than that. I don't have time to go into all the convolutions of the argument, but I hope you get the point. But there can be other explanations for why we're religious, which are non-evolutionary at all. And other secular social scientific explanations would say, for example, like Michael Shermer does, he's a skeptic, that people are so stubbornly religious because of their need for pattern and meaning. And this is why people see the face of Mary or Jesus in donuts or in clouds or whatever. So, yeah, okay, we need pattern and meaning, but let's push those explanations as far as possible. Why not? Why not admit that religion is reproductively advantageous? I don't think that's a bad explanation, nor do I think we need to deny that we need pattern and meaning and that maybe religion has something to do with our need for pattern and meaning. But I would want to ask, do those two explanations or layers of explanation rule out another possibility? We are religious because the infinite has grasped hold of us in the same way that the good grasped hold of Socrates and constituted the ultimate explanation for why he's sitting there in prison with his friends. And this leads me to a new definition of reductionism. Reductionism usually meant, in the past, the attempt to break complex things down into their subordinate parts and then to explain the whole in terms of this set of subordinate parts, such as atoms and molecules and so forth. That's usually what is meant by reductionism. But I think a better definition of reductionism is this. Reductionism is the suppression of layered explanation. And that allows the religious person, including the theologian, to be just as reductionist as the new atheist. For example, if the theologian or the religious person says the diversity of life comes about because of divine creativity, rather than because of evolutionary processes or natural selection. That seems to me to be reductionist also, just as reductionist as saying diversity exists because of natural selection rather than because of divine creativity. In principle and logically speaking, there's no reason for not holding a multiplicity of levels. I've talked only about three, just to make things simple. Actually, I think explanation runs endlessly deep, and we never reach the bottom of it all because there is an inexhaustible dimension of depth that underlies nature and the world. And here I want to point out to me what I think is the biggest logical flaw in all of Richard Dawkins' fulminations against religion and theology. He always appeals, either implicitly or explicitly, to what has been called Occam's razor. Now, Occam's razor is a principle that was formulated by a late medieval monk, William of Ockham, who said that if there are a plurality of competing explanations to explain one phenomenon or set of phenomena, then a good rule of thumb is to pick the explanation which makes the fewest assumptions. In other words, to pick the simplest explanation. To pick, in mathematical terms, the one which is most algorithmically compressible. To pick the simplest mathematical explanation, rather than to mess up your explanations by appealing to extraneous explanations which you don't need. Now, if Dawkins were here tonight, he would look at my notion of layered explanation and say, "You're violating Occam's razor by allowing for theological explanations to exist alongside of scientific explanation." Now that we have a Darwinian explanation for living phenomena, including religion, morality, and intelligence, why do we need to bring in theological explanation at all? He comes back to this argument time and time again and says that we're violating Occam's razor by appealing to theology. But he forgets that Occam's razor applies only to competing explanations. And the whole point of my discussion of the teapot was to show that there's no competition between the explanation "I want tea" and the molecular motion at the other end. Furthermore, you're not going to find "I want tea" as long as you're exploring the boiling water at the level of the molecular motion. Likewise, you're not going to find "God wants diversity and spontaneity in life" while you're doing evolutionary biology. You should not be looking for the hand of God. And this is why intelligent design argumentation seems to me so theologically as well as scientifically misguided. Intelligent design is an attempt to force a theological explanation, the "I want tea" type explanation, into the molecular motion level of explanation. It's not necessary to do that if you can allow, in the first place, for explanatory pluralism. I'm about finished, but I wanted to say a word about morality and about intelligence. Why are we ethical beings? That's a question that the naturalist, the evolutionary naturalist who does not believe in God, has to answer in purely natural terms. Immanuel Kant would have said we're ethical beings because in some way the divine command is imprinted upon our hearts. And for him, the moral impulse that we all experience is as good a proof for the existence of God as anything else that we could think of, although he was also enamored by the starry skies above. Why are we ethical beings? Traditionally, the answer is because we have been influenced in our heart of hearts by divine reality. The evolutionists would say, no, we're ethical beings because moral behavior has helped human genes, cooperative human genes, have been more successful at getting into the next generation than uncooperative ones have been. Now, my sense is, well, let's push that explanation as far as we can. I'm not at all, as a theologian, opposed to evolutionary explanations of morality. I'm intrigued by them, and I think probably as they develop, they will add significantly to our understanding of moral existence. What I'm opposed to is an explanatory monism, which suggests that once we've explained morality at the level of evolution, we have gotten to the bottom of it, that we fully explained it adequately. Another explanation for morality seems to me, and this is purely secular also, but non-evolutionary, we're moral because morality promotes human community and happiness, something that we all think are goods. Couldn't you accept both of these levels of explanation and push them as far as you can, and at the same time say we are moral beings because each of us is grasped by an ultimate unconditional goodness to which our moral life is in some sense, even if only tacitly, a response? Even the new atheists, after all, have to have a sense of absolute moral rightness. For example, when Christopher Hitchens writes his book, God is Not Great, what he means is God is not morally great. But for him to make such a judgment, Christopher Hitchens has to have a tacit sense of what is morally good, morally great. And it's against the background of some tacit sense of moral rightness or uprightness that he issues his very powerful and passionate condemnation of religion for promoting so much immorality. So this tacit sense of rightness is something that has grasped hold of Hitchens' consciousness just as much as rightness grasped hold of each one of us. And I don't think Hitchens would agree to this, but I think in some sense he has surrendered himself to the good, at least in some sense of the term, and that's what motivates him so passionately to go around the country giving speeches, debating with theologians and so forth, and writing books on how evil religion is. The role of theology, I see it, however, is to go beyond this and to ask, and I'm not going to try to do it here, about the ultimate ground of this sense of rightness that even the new atheist has to have in order to convince so many people of the rightness of their criticism of religion. Finally, and very quickly, I wanted to say one final word about intelligence, because if there is no God to explain intelligence, if there is no theological explanation, of intelligence, then there has to be a purely natural explanation of intelligence. And this is what the new atheists, especially those who follow Darwinian evolutionary naturalism, are trying to do. So let's ask the question, why am I engaged in thought? Let's assume, be generous now, that there's something like thought going on up here in my mind right now. Why am I engaged in thought, even at this hour of the day? One answer, and let's push this as far as possible, is to say, because my neurons are firing, synapses are connecting. Another one at the same scientific level would be to say, I'm thinking because the brain is a very adaptive organism. So yeah, let's push the evolutionary explanation and the neuroscientific explanation of mind as far as possible and in no way try to compete with it or conflict with it. But I could also answer the question, it seems to me quite honestly, I'm up here thinking because of my desire to understand and know what intelligence is, what life is, what religion is, what atheism is. And that's a different kind of explanation, but it's just as valid as I turn the gas on in comparison with the molecular movement in the kettle. And at some level, if I thoroughly think about the question, why am I engaged in thought, I would have to bring in the fact that this universe that I live in is intelligible. If the universe were not intelligible, I would not be thinking. Mind would never have emerged in the history of evolution unless its ultimate environment were an intelligible universe. Just to use a little analogy here to close with, just as the existence of light waves is necessary in order to account for the evolution of vision some 45 different times in the history of life on our planet in different phyla, different phylogenies, without light, vision would never have come about. There would have been no need for it to have come about. Likewise, the intelligibility of the universe has to be a pervasive fact of our environment, of our terrestrial, of our Big Bang universe's environment, in order for mind to have emerged in evolution on this Earth and perhaps elsewhere in this Big Bang universe. We don't know, but since the Big Bang universe now, we realize, is quite intelligible even from our terrestrial precincts, we can assume it's intelligible from other vantage points as well. So the evolution of mind would require, as one causal factor, the existence of intelligibility in the universe. And it would seem to me that there is still, in an age of science, room for theological inquiry, alongside, of course, other kinds of inquiry, including all sorts of scientific and social scientific kinds of inquiry, but especially theological inquiry into the question, why is the universe intelligible at all? There's lots more to be said on this topic, but I've run out of time. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you very much, Professor Hutt. We realize that some people need to get up and do their homework, but Dr. Hutt is willing to use his last energy of the day fielding the questions that some of you may want to linger and ask. So, in light of that, if you have questions, please come forward and speak your question on this microphone, and Dr. Burke, one of our local scientists, will hold the mic for you to express your question, and Dr. Hutt will answer.
Thank you for coming to Creighton, Dr. Hutt. It's certainly been a pleasure. One question I have for you is a recurring motif in the works of the new atheists, from Sam Harris to Christopher Hitchens to Richard Dawkins, is their citation of studies which reveal that amongst professional scientists in the United States and, of course, in Europe, the prevalence of belief in what they call a personal God is very low. Yeah. And they, of course, cite this with satisfaction, implying that naturally the more intelligent and the more exposed to science you are, the less likely you are to hold traditional religious beliefs. However, I would like to ask you, why do you think this is? My personal belief is that this may be somewhat, because these studies are obviously irrefutable, is that this may be somewhat related to the fact that our Western culture has become so entrenched in scientism, like you mentioned earlier, and misuse of Occam's razor, that professional scientists who spend so many years getting a doctorate and then being immersed in science are just so immersed in scientism as well. Do you suppose that this might be the case?
Yes, I think in many ways you've given pretty much what I would answer too. It's the privileging of what I call spectator evidence, which has been increasing in the intellectual world, and it's become almost the conventional wisdom in many philosophy departments. I've visited a lot of universities. Since I've been doing science and religion, I've gone to a lot of universities where the philosophy departments, for example, are made up primarily of proponents of scientism. So in a sense, almost philosophy has become the handmaiden of science to some extent. And that's because spectator evidence is something that has led to so much success in, as far as science, technology, engineering, so forth is concerned. It dominates our culture, it dominates our consciousness. Plus, it's something that's not controversial. It's something that can easily be shared from Japan to the eastern United States. Scientific communities can agree on what constitutes good evidence for this or that scientific idea. Whereas when you get into the world of religion and faith, you're getting into an area where, as I put it, a kind of transformative process is necessary, and there is a great deal of subjectivity, and there's also in the religious world a great deal of diversity as to what constitutes the appropriate images or concepts with which to talk about ultimate reality. All of that seems so cloudy, so confusing, and so forth. But I think in many ways the largest explanation is that since Descartes, we have idealized clear and distinct ideas. Descartes' project was to place all of thought on the foundation of clear and distinct ideas. And mathematics and scientific abstractions allow us to come up with much more clarity as far as our ideas are concerned than we find in the fuzzy symbolic language of religion. So there's a problem there, I think, in that we arrive at our clarity and distinctness only by leaving out most of reality. I've been deeply influenced in my thinking about these things by Alfred North Whitehead. Alfred North Whitehead was very critical of Descartes. Alfred North Whitehead said, seek clarity, but then mistrust it, because whatever clarity you've purchased as in spectator evidence, you have purchased at the price of leaving out most of the real world. So now let's go back and retrieve what we've left out. But we can't retrieve it with the clear and distinct symbols of mathematics. We can only do it with the fuzzy symbols of myth, metaphor, analogy, the language that religions use. So there's a price we have to pay necessarily in clarity to arrive at the fundamental reality, Whitehead would say. And not everybody's willing to pay that price. The ideal of clarity and distinctness, which is the hallmark of so much modern thought, has edged out symbolic, metaphoric, analogical, poetic discourse or expression as invalid, and in fact as fuzzy projection. I could go on and on about this, but I think it's primarily that idealization of clarity and distinctness over the fuzziness of symbolic expression. There's much more to be said, but.
Thank you. Hello, Dr. Hout. Thank you for your presentation. I had one simple question. Your studies over the years, obviously, you've had to go in depth as to see where the neurosis of, is it religion that first became neurotic with science, or was it science that was attacking religion? I just wondered on which level this whole discussion leaned towards, you know, coming back from Newton's discovery of calculus and Galileo's discovery of the universe, but is there some point where you feel like science was persecuting religion, or was religion trying to subvert science? Just your observation.
Well, Galileo, interesting and ironically, the great founders of science, Newton and Robert Boyle and Galileo, and throughout the history of science, Maxwell and up to today. Recently, Theodosius Dobzhansky, the great geneticist, and so forth. There have been many, many scientists, maybe even the majority, who've had no trouble reconciling their religious faith with scientific ideas. That there's room for both, but in a way, theology made a big mistake, as the Jesuit writer and theologian Michael Buckley has written a huge book called At the Origins of Modern Atheism. The theologians made a big mistake when they followed Newton and Boyle in thinking that they had to find a place for God within the physical system that science was beginning to talk about. And when Voltaire and Diderot and the encyclopedists and other modern enlightened figures came along, and Laplace, and said, we have no need of this God hypothesis. The system is self-contained. The laws of inertia, for example, seem to work without having to be nudged by any deity. Wolfhard Pannenberg, a theologian, thinks that the theme of inertia and momentum in modern physics has been quite influential in the intellectual world in making the idea of God seem superfluous intellectually. And so theologians made a big mistake by tying God to a physical system, Buckley says, rather than to this transformative religious experience that should be the evidence, if you will, for theological discourse. We look for evidence in the spectator arena rather than in the transformative arena. Seek, again, it's a good pedagogical axiom. Seek simplicity, seek clarity, but then mistrust it. Well, we've sought clarity, but we haven't mistrusted it. And what that's led to is the idea that the universe itself consists of essentially quantifiable aspects, colorless, odorless, valueless, purposeless. And then we humans emerged on this planet with our longing for meaning and warmth and pattern, and we projected onto this impersonal universe a coding, a fictitious coding, through our religions. But now the new atheists are telling us, as men of the Enlightenment, to wake up and face the fact that the universe is impersonal, valueless, so forth, and just learn to live with it without faith, as it were. So there's a really profound and profoundly interesting intellectual history, which I can't go into, and which I'm really not the sufficient expert on to go into because it's so convoluted. But I think what I said tonight is at least part of the truth, that the privileging of spectator, abstract, clear and distinct ideas over the kind of transformative arena where symbols are required for transformation, where in the Catholic experience, for example, the sacraments are necessary for this kind of personal transformation that will allow you to come into contact with the reality of the divine. That debate is still very much going on. But the point I want to emphasize is that the side that the new atheists take is just as much based upon a groundless belief, as they say, our own religious life is based on. There is no scientific evidence that science is the only road to truth, or that spectator evidence is the only kind that counts. That's a belief. It's a commitment. They've committed themselves to a kind of explanatory monism, whereas I'm suggesting let's commit ourselves. And this is a leap, too. I'm suggesting a leap, too. Commit yourself to an explanatory pluralism. You have a better chance of coming into contact with the rich texture of reality than if you decide there's only one explanatory slot available. And you better, by God, get your ideas in there if you expect them to be accepted by the intellectual community.
Nicolai Roddy, Theology Department. Thank you for a very stimulating presentation, Dr. Hott. I'd like to suggest and have you comment on the suggestion that another important point to add to the transformative evidence that it seems to me that the wisdom traditions of all the great religions share, and that ironically the new atheists don't seem to have a clue about, is a kind of principle of self-negation.
Yes.
This idea that that somehow we need to get ourselves out of the way.
Yes.
To allow ultimate reality, to allow a truer view of reality, and to allow ultimate reality to be seen. We see it in Job, for example, self-negating within the biblical wisdom tradition. We see Jesus saying, "Why do you call me good? There is none good but the Father." We see it in Socrates. We don't see it in the new atheists.
Yes. That's a very good point, I think, and I would essentially agree with this. If you start asking the question, why is spectator evidence, for example, privileged so much in our intellectual culture? I don't know exactly how you would answer that, but if you look at it from, say, a psychological point of view, Viktor Frankl, great psychologist, has responded to the effect that spectator knowledge appeals to our will to power, whereas knowledge should actually be something that we arrive at by way of humble adherence to the desire to know and let ourselves get out of the way so that we can let reality carry us away. But there's an element of control. The scientific method itself lends itself to a kind of experimental control type of approach to things. And I'm not being critical of that at all. But if you let that become a pervasive cultural imperative or pervasive way of approaching persons and everything else, including the religious experience, then you have to ask, is this the product of the will to power or of the humble desire to know? And that's a decision that each one of us has to make, I think. And there's no coincidence that a culture that has experienced such dizzying success technologically is going to idealize a kind of method which allows us to have so much control. And we're now experiencing the sober ecological implications of that will to control reality. And it's also partly, I think, a result of the specialization that takes place in our intellectual culture today. Frankl again said the problem is not that people specialize. The problem is that specialists generalize. And we take our particular area of expertise and try to take it as and make it perhaps the fundamental explanation. So what I'm proposing is, I guess, a degree of humility that allows us to relax our own particular expertise and allow for a plurality of levels of explanation. So that commitment to explanatory pluralism, I think, does require the virtue of humility, of opening yourself to other ways of looking at things. That's not required in explanatory monism. Maybe I'm being too judgmental here, but there are a lot of philosophers and a lot of psychologists who made the same point.
Thank you for your presentation. I'm a little puzzled in one aspect of it in terms of where it leaves us with respect to what do we believe and how do we decide what to believe. And in particular, tying in a couple of things that I thought I heard you say. One is with respect to the literal interpretation of religious tracts such as the Bible, the Quran, etc. If I understand you correctly, you reject literal interpretations. And yet there's very substantial detail in these books such as the Bible. And so one question that I have that's related to the question question that I'll get to is, well, how do you decide which parts of these texts are meant to be taken literally and which are not? And is that not in some way problematic? Yes. And then given what you said about evidence or generally about what you say is the mistake that the new atheists make in terms of how to construe evidence, how does one decide, how does one take evidence or any other process and make a decision? Say I was came into adulthood without ever been in a faith tradition, mm-hmm. and I've decided I want faith, and I've narrowed it down to, say, choosing between being a Roman Catholic, a Sunni Muslim, a Mormon, and maybe a secular humanist that believes there's likely to be a God. How would I decide that? What kind of process would I go through?
Well, I'm not sure I can give a good answer to that. It's a very, very good question. I think it's one that we all have to wrestle with. First of all, I'm inspired to be critical of literalism because of the Bible itself. But St. Paul's expression in Corinthians, the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life. And St. Paul was especially one who was aware that in order to come into contact with the reality of Christ and the salvific significance of Christ and the all-importance of Christ, one has to undergo this process of transformation. That he talked a lot about faith as bringing us justification, faith as bringing us into contact with the really real, and how that involves our surrendering certain kind of literalism. Because the essence of literalism, and I also tied this into scientism, which I think is a kind of literalism too, is to deliver us of the burden, if you will, or of the challenge, would be a better term, of changing ourselves so as to conform, so as to achieve the adequatio, the proportionality that would bring us into contact with religious evidence. And that's not something that is easily done. This transformative process is one that requires initiation. And you mentioned how, you know, if you grew up as a Hindu, you would be initiated into the world in a completely different way from the way the Christian or Buddhist or modern secularist is. My response to that is, would you really value something that in order to come into contact with it, you didn't have to go through some sort of initiation process, which involves the whole life, which involves being born into a particular culture with its rites and rituals and so forth. Something that would come to us so cheaply as just taking a look, which is what spectator evidence is all about, I just wonder if that could have the transformative effect, the delighting effect. Could it bring us a sense of fulfillment that we have when we do undergo an initiation rite or set of rites, or we do immerse ourselves in a tradition? And here I'm speaking primarily from my own experience as a Catholic theologian. I was born into a Catholic family. I was able to attend good theology schools and became more and more excited about my faith the more I was initiated into it by mentors who themselves had been initiated, by those who had been initiated before them, and so forth. So I felt part of this great community, this cloud of witnesses, as the letter to the Hebrews refers to our ancestors in the faith. That sense of the cloud of witnesses that Hebrews talks about brought great comfort to me. And I couldn't do what I do or think the thoughts or have the religious sentiments I have without having been influenced by a tradition over which this cloud of witnesses and martyrs and wise men and women throughout the ages have brought as a kind of cumulative framework for my life. I don't see that as something that interferes with objectivity, religiously speaking. I see that as something that actually promotes objectivity. In science, you know, you have to bring your ideas before a community of other scientists. You publish your ideas in peer-reviewed journals and so forth. So there's often this is lost. There's a kind of traditional authoritativeness that bears the scientific tradition along as well, as Michael Polanyi especially has brought out. I don't see that as entirely different from what goes on in religions, where it's not just my own subjectivity that's at issue here. My subjectivity has to be tested within this large community of fellow believers. It's not as mathematical, it's not as quantitative, but it's just as powerful. I have to, whenever I have a theological idea, for example, when I talk about Darwin and his being compatible with Christian faith, I have to give some reasons why the tradition, the biblical tradition, the theological tradition, can find that acceptable. So it's not as though it's just arbitrary. There's a community and an authoritativeness about communities, both in science and faith, that we often forget that makes them much more similar than they seem. So initiation is not something that's to be shunned as though that somehow prevents our coming into contact with truthfulness, but rather it's something that facilitates it. We still have a lot of questions that remain, and one of those questions is, well, how can Buddhist truth be reconciled with Christian truth? But as I see what's happening in the religious world today, especially in interreligious conversation, those are questions which I don't think can be answered a priori, but as the discussions and conversations go on, I think we're going to find that the membranes that separate our traditions are more porous, perhaps, than we had thought in the past. And that eventually we can arrive at some very, very rich inter-religious and interdenominational theologies. As a theologian today, I think of myself primarily as an ecumenical theologian. I get my ideas as much from Protestant theologians as I do from Catholic theologians. And I find that cross-fertilization to be a very enriching one. Which I suspect is going to occur in interreligious dialogue as well in the future.
Well, I think it's a tribute to our speaker that this many people have lingered behind and that his energy has been stimulated by your questions. I think it's a testament to the reality of the subject matter and the way Dr. Hutt has been able to approach this. Thank you once again.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a program from the Creighton University Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We've heard the conclusion of a lecture by John F. Haught, Senior Fellow in Science and Religion at the Woodstock Theological Center at Georgetown University, and author of several books, including the upcoming Making Sense of Evolution, Darwin, God, and the Drama of Life, to be published by Westminster John Knox Press. Dr. Haught's topic was Science, Faith, and the New Atheism. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, September 24, 2009, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Special thanks also to Creighton Theology Professor Gail Risch for her help in the production of this program. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.